Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book about some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. My guest for this episode is Andrew Denning, assistant professor of history at the University of Kansas. We are discussing his new book, Skiing into Modernity, A Cultural and Environmental History, published in 2014 by the University of California Press as part of their new series, Sport in World History. Andy's book examines the history of alpine or downhill skiing. As we learn in the interview, alpine skiing developed only in the late 1800s out of the older Nordic method of skiing, what we call cross-country. Of course, as the name suggests, this innovation took place in the German and Austrian Alps, a region regarded at the time as a backward, isolated corner of Europe. One of Andy's main arguments, and what makes this book about much more than sport, is that the development and popularity of this new form of skiing transformed the region where it was invented. Today, the Alps draw tourists from across Europe and around the world. They are a land of modern luxury resorts and mountainsides altered by groomed slopes and ski lifts. And the sport that began as a way for turn-of-the-century city dwellers to connect with nature is now one of high-tech equipment and high-speed racers. Andy discusses these changes to the sport, its place in 20th century popular culture, and the way it has shaped the landscape of the Alps. Here is our interview. My guest this week on New Books in Sports is Andy Denning. Andy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Bruce.
So to start, I'll ask you to give us a bit of introduction of yourself. Tell us where you're from, how you got into the study of history, and in particular, what led you to the history of skiing.
Certainly. So I grew up in Reno, Nevada. Went to University of Nevada, Reno as an undergraduate. I went on to do my graduate study at UC Davis over the mountains, if you're familiar with the geography there. And just in terms of my interest in the subject, sport was always something that I had been fairly obsessed with as a child. I was focused follower of the box scores for whatever the sport in season was. But we were also big, big outdoors people with the mountains at our doorstep and the sort of eastern foothills of the Sierra Nevada. And so that was definitely a part of my upbringing, especially summer activities, being up in the mountains. And so as I was going through grad school and working through comps and coursework and all of that, I always had this in the back of my mind. I was interested in environmental history. I was interested in sports. And I was convinced that these were, I think, more sort of esoteric personal interests for a while. But as I started to get into it, I definitely started to put things together in terms of the potential for this project. The work that had been done was, I think, there was fairly little work given how important skiing was, particularly for a Europeanist in the case of the Alps, knowing what skiing means to those countries, to the people who live there, to the economies there. And I think that there was this nice mix of sort of the personal and the professional in terms of coming to this topic. I'm actually someone who's not a skier. I grew up at the base of the mountains. I had lots of friends who skied, but I think it's one of those situations where it's all the more interesting because you realize how little you know about something that is popular and important and has its own culture and vocabulary. So a lot of my friends were skiers. I was not a skier. My parents were from Southern California. It just wasn't something we did. Mm-hmm. And so I think there was kind of this allure of getting to know more about something that obviously had lots of meaning to people. So it was a nice way to learn as well. And I like to think that I can be perfectly objective because I'm not a skier myself.
Mm-hmm. You refer to yourself as a Europeanist, and this book focuses in particular on Germany and Austria. So that's part of your training as well, right? As a scholar of German and Austrian history?
Correct. So I would say it deals more generally with the Alps. I think the interesting part of this history is that I think it is a German focused history, especially mm-hmm. in the pre-World War II era, where you certainly see this developing in the Eastern Alps of what's now Germany, Austria, Italy, the Südtirol area, Switzerland. But that from the beginning, this is a very transnational kind of culture that develops. So they're constantly in conversation with the French in the French Alps of the Northwest, with the Italians, and in particular, one of the sort of interesting quirks of history with Britons who decamp to Switzerland for weeks and months over the winter. So I think while this is a German-dominated culture, particularly before World War II, it's a very transnational culture that begins to sort of forge these connections back and forth across the mountains.
Mm-hmm. And so, yes, as what you say, it's a transnational history, and yet also it's a regional history. And something that I was struck by is that really your principal argument is that skiing was integral to the history of the Alps since the 19th century. So can you talk about really what's the main argument of your book?
Yeah, so there's, I think we so connect the Alps and skiing that it's we need to historicize
it
because it seems so eternal in many ways. Skiing comes to the Alps around 1880, and it had developed earlier in the mid-19th century in Scandinavia in particular. And it definitely developed this kind of what in Germany you would call folkish character, something that's very much rooted in kind of romantic national identity. This is particularly for Norwegians who are trying to separate themselves from the Swedes who are ruling them in the mid-19th century. And as it comes to Central Europe in the 1880s, it's brought most often by Norwegian students, basically, who are studying in German universities in particular, metallurgy, mining, engineering, these sorts of things. So it comes to the Alps and you have this perception of, in Europe at this time period, that skiing is somehow quaint, exotic, because it's coming from this peripheral region of Northern Europe. Similarly, we see the Alps as of the late 19th century, Europeans who live in urban metropolises where business is done, where culture is developing, view the Alps as a backwards place, mm-hmm. basically. So as industrialization is occurring in the 19th century, we see a lot of traditional forms of industry that used to be performed in the Alps being brought down into the lowlands where it can be done more efficiently through industrial methods. And so there is this perception that the Alps are kind of benighted region. It's a place where Cretans live, where there's very little contact with the outside world, and there's value only insofar as it is a place for urbanites to escape modern urban life. So it's seen in many ways as the opposite of modernity in many ways. And so this is sort of the two contexts that are set up as of the late 19th century. Skiing is backwards, peripheral, quaint, exotic, so too are the Alps. But as these two things come into contact, there's this process that develops in which each comes to modernize the other. So my core argument is that skiing comes to modernize the Alps, particularly over the course of the 20th century, just as the Alps comes to modernize skiing. And this is in terms of the practice of the sport, in terms of the perception of the sport, and indeed in reciprocal terms, the way that the sport comes to shift understandings of the Alps from being backwards to something that is not peripheral to European concerns, but indeed at the center of Europe as a kind of manifestation of high culture, luxury, and a sort of cosmopolitanism that points towards the future rather than towards the past.
So when skiing arrives in the Alps, it's still Nordic skiing, correct? Meaning cross-country skiing, or what we would think of as cross-country skiing.
Correct. So yeah, there's an act of translation to occur here because the way the sport has developed before it arrives in the Alps is very much a response to the landscapes in which it's developed in Scandinavia in particular. So there's certainly a sort of flatlands Nordic skiing, what we would call cross country, in the lowland areas of places like Sweden, Finland, for example, and then more of the sort of telemark style that develops in the mountains in Western Norway in particular. But the practice of the sport in these areas and the equipment of the sport is not so conducive to what people would need to do in the Alps. So as you're getting this move into Central Europe, the first attempts at skiing are less on the sort of alpine sheer slopes that we imagine occurring today, but what we in German would call Mittelgebirge. So these kind of mid-range mountains, more rolling hills, as essentially you see Norwegian students and the people who they're passing the sport off to in Central Europe trying to practice it in similar landscapes as it was practiced in Scandinavia. So this means they're often using much longer skis than what we would understand today for alpine skiing, oftentimes up to 2 to 3 meters in length, and doing it in the same way as it had been done in Scandinavia. At this time, you're right, it is a kind of hybrid Nordic skiing. It's what they often call ski touring. So we imagine people riding lifts coming back down, straight downhill. This is, as people would say in this time period, it's a sort of complete sport in which you're going to do some climbing, you're going to do some flatlands, and then you'll get the occasional sort of downhill run. But the real idea is to respond to the landscape. And the landscapes chosen here are very much an echo of what people were doing in Scandinavia in the mid-19th century.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask, so this is thought of when it first arrives in the Alps as a leisure activity, an exercise, but also something with a strong romantic tinge to it, that you go out into nature, correct?
Correct. So this is something that is meant to fulfill a number of roles. One is to create pleasure for the individual. So it's something that's a form of entertainment. It's a way to get exercise during the winter. There are many writers in this time period who talk about how the winter in Europe is fundamentally unhealthy. It forces people to stay inside. They breathe bad air. They sort of engage in what one author calls a vita minima. So the kind of essential hibernation that people experience, particularly in some of these rural areas, mountainous areas. So there's a fundamental physical need for this sport, they say, but also a spiritual one. In a time when they say people are becoming alienated from natural landscapes, when they're being forced into unnatural modes of existence, as they're being caught up in industrial processes, as cities are expanding, people are saying that this is a necessity for people's minds, bodies, and souls, that they need this sport in order to connect themselves with something pure, something timeless. And this romantic view of the landscape comes to play a major role here in terms of the appeal of skiing at the very beginning here in the late 19th century.
Mm-hmm. In one of your early chapters, you introduce two figures who are important to the development of alpine skiing, and you call them the ski popes. And so can you tell us about these two figures and their influence?
Yeah, so these are two sort of figureheads for this larger debate that occurs around the turn of the century, particularly in sort of the Eastern Alps and in the Germanic culture of skiing. And I should note here that I'm not the one who has invented the term ski popes, unfortunately. I wish I had. This is something that is basically put on them by the sporting media in this time period, because there's this schismatic division, which they see as very much echoing splits in the church earlier in European history. So we have these two figureheads. One of them is Wilhelm Palka, who is a professor in Western Germany, professor of geology, and he is very much the ski pope at the head of this so-called Nordic school. He skis in the Black Forest, which is near where he teaches, and he is very much a pioneer in these early years. He gets his skis for the first time when he's very young. I believe it's 1883, and he's essentially living in Davos over the winter because of his health problems. So he comes from a sort of upper middle class family. And this is the way that many people get into skiing, these sanatoria, which begin to stay open into the winter months to essentially help people recover from these various maladies, particularly things like tuberculosis. So he's one ski pope here, and I'll talk a bit more about him. The other is a Moravian Austrian by the name of Matthias Starsky, and he is a fascinating character, a kind of self-made Renaissance man. He studies art. He gets very involved in the German practice of turnin, the kind of focused gymnastics, which has these romantic nationalist and at times militarist tinges as well. And at some point, he, as an artist and as a man of the world, decides to decamp to the Austrian Alpine foothills in the winter, and starts to take up skiing as a way to essentially get around. And while he's there, as a man who is in many ways a kind of inventor, he sees the world around him. He wants to bend it to his will, as he says at times. He begins to change both the equipment and the style of skiing to suit these very steep hills. So we have these two different ski popes, Palka, who for Central European skiing culture represents this sort of heir to Nordic skiing, who says the Norwegians, the Swedes have figured this out. We should just be echoing what they do. And Starsky, who says, we are glad to have received these practices and the equipment from them, but we need to make changes to this in order to suit these landscapes that surround us, right? And so I should note here that this debate is very much black and white. There's a lot of gray area between here. So Palka, for example, is famous for summiting many alpine peaks for the first time on skis. So this is as the head of this so-called Nordic school in Central Europe, and yet he practices the sport in the Alps themselves. So this is a constructed debate at times, but it becomes a very vociferous debate and one that creates a lot of enemies. It's worked out through the media. And essentially, this is an argument about where people should be skiing, how they should be skiing, what their attitude should be towards the inventors of the modern sport in Scandinavia. And so, as I argue, a lot of this has to do with attitudes towards the environment and the landscapes in which the sport is being practiced. But there's also something more fundamental here separating Palka's school from Starsky's school, which is their ideal for the sport itself and how it should be practiced. Palka is very much, we might call him an elitist, someone who thinks that the sport will be at its healthiest and at its best when you have a committed elite, right? So he says, we don't want to spread this as widely as possible. We want to be sure that the people who practice the sport are truly committed to it. So I should note here that the style that he represents is a much, there's a much steeper learning curve. It's difficult to practice in the way that the Nordic skiers had. So he says, this is exactly the point. We should have some of these barriers for we know that we're practicing the sport to its highest level and to be sure that people are truly committed. Starsky, on the other hand, is very much a democrat in many ways. He says we should lower the barriers of entry to the sport as much as possible so that we get the widest amount of people possible practicing the sport. Because he says if we all agree that the sport is a necessity for modern European life, then we should not be erecting these artificial barriers, essentially. So he starts to alter the practice of the sport, not just to suit the landscape around him, but also to make it much, much simpler. He says he strips away artifice from the practice and makes it very, very functional. So a new series of turns, which are a kind of jump turns in these very steep landscapes. And he puts his money where his mouth is, essentially. He teaches these huge ski courses of dozens, eventually hundreds of people. He says, I can teach you to ski in 2 or 3 days. And he says it might not be as elegant or as well practiced as what Palka is doing, but the point is that we want as many people as possible to have an entry point into the sport, and then they can perfect their technique as they move forward. And so there's a real debate here, not only about the equipment and the landscapes in which people should be skiing, but indeed about who we want skiing. Do we want a committed elite, or do we want as many people as possible? And this really rages on between about 1895 to 1905. And eventually you get a sort of synthesis between their two styles, which is, I think, made concrete by World War I when you have the widespread training of ski troops by most of the belligerent powers, which sort of enshrines this more hybrid approach and puts this debate into the background.
So in the early 20th century, skiing is gaining popularity as a leisure activity, as a form of exercise. Then during the war is even a military activity. When is it then that the Alps become a skiing destination for Europeans outside of the Alpine regions?
You certainly see this developing in the interwar era. So certainly you saw people practicing the sport in these more traditional touristic destinations before World War I. So places like Davos in Switzerland, Chamonix in France, you see people who were there into the winter season, basically developing the sport from this infrastructure that already existed. But after World War I, you start to see a lot more touristic development. So we get huge investments by transportation companies, for example, which are, you've likely seen a number of the posters from this time period, which are attempting to glamorize skiing. Oftentimes these are put out by national railway corporations, for example. And so there's certainly investments being put in. There's advertising being put out there. But also just the democratization of the sport after World War I is a really key point as well. As we see a number of these soldiers who have been trained as ski troops returning home and wanting to practice the sport for leisure reasons, spreading it to their friends, their family, their children. So we get a large growth in skiers in the mid in the 1920s in particular. And this, I think, is indicative of a larger growth in sporting clubs and leisure associations that we see across Europe in the 1920s as well. So then we really start to see the Alps becoming this sort of touristic destination. And there's a very symbiotic relationship developing here between these Alpine communities and businessmen there who want to create more economic activity for them. This is basically seen as a way to double income in many ways. They've been forced to appeal to tourists only in the summer season, let's say April to September. Now they can fill out the rest of the year, October to March, with tourists. So there's some great interest there. And then for skiers, there's much to be gained in the Alps as well. They're quite convenient in terms of getting to them from various European metropolises. But the sport begins to shift in the interwar period as well, where we start to see this preference for what we would come to define as the Alpine form of skiing. So less interest in this sort of complete form of Alpine touring, where you'll be doing a lot of climbing, you'll be going downhill, you'll be going through the flatlands. It becomes apparent that the thing that makes Alpine skiing unique and so desirable is the downhill, this rush of speed that people really come to identify with in the interwar period, which reflects these other developments in European culture with automobiles, airplanes, these sorts of things. And so that's where you start to see this symbiosis really developing with the development of ski lifts in particular, starting in the late 1920s, really expanding in the 1930s, where essentially the sport and the mountainside are altered to suit the needs of skiing consumers, basically. So this is when we start to see a shift from the sport being practiced in previous Alpine tourism destinations that had existed for decades and in some cases over a century to these new purpose-built skiing destinations. And the real trailblazer here is Sestriere in Italy, in northwestern Italy in the Alps, which is built by the head of Fiat with lots of support from Mussolini's fascist government. And the idea here is to build a purpose-built skiing destination. The people who are reporting on this call this a ski resort built in the snow desert. Essentially, there was nothing there. They looked around northwestern Italy to figure out the best possible place to put this. And then they built a hotel. They built this huge network of lifts so that everything here was built for the needs of the skier. So I think over the course of the 15, 20 years between World War I and the rising tensions that lead to World War II, you really see this shift towards a sport that's built around this some might say fetishization of speed, and changing the experience for the tourist to one that is, I think, very familiar to us in 20th century, in which everything is catered to the needs of the tourist. And so they're trying to bring all of these goods and services that comprise alpine tourism, skiing tourism, under one roof, both to suit the needs of skiers and also to make as much profit as possible. So there's a symbiosis, I think, between the needs of producers and the needs of consumers, which really accrues to the growth of the sport in the interwar period.
So you mentioned the democratization of the sport in the 20s and 30s. And one thing that you do discuss is that as the sport gains popularity, it is somewhat unique in that it's also a sport that is open to women. And in the advertisements and in the posters that you mentioned, women are featured prominently.
Correct. There's a very interesting and I think paradoxical relationship that or attitude we see developing among practitioners of the sport regarding women. From the very beginnings in the late 19th century, there's an acceptance of women practicing the sport. And this has so much to do with the physical experience of the sport. There had been so much worry about women riding bicycles, for example, women playing soccer, for reasons of physical constitution, essentially. They were worried about this having effects on women's health and their ability to bear children. And skiing allows women to take part because it's essentially a non-violent sport. The kinetics of the sport, the kinesthetic of the sport, is based on this sort of flowing movement, which doesn't involve these jerks and thrashes. There's not contact. And so this is something that people who are on the fence and worried about women taking part in sport are able to say this is an acceptable form of women's sport, so long as they're not engaging in strenuous competition, so long as they're not sprinting. These are things that women can take part in. And so from the very beginning, a lot of these ski tours are involve both men and women. And this is seen as a particularly useful social arena in which men and women can come together as equals, which is very different from the salons. It's very different from the home life, that this is a place where they can really come together. And so this is there from the very beginning. And yet, this is not a sort of pure form of gender equality. Women are still expected to know their place. Matthias Starsky, who is in many ways a sort of progressive, infamously tells them that they need to both hold their line and hold their tongue when they're out on ski tours with men. So they're meant to complement men, and they're allowed to be there. But this is not the kind of true equality we might imagine. Then in the interwar period, as we see the democratization, the growth of mass culture, increasing commercialization, not just of skiing or tourism of sport, but indeed of European societies more generally, women are often used in these advertisements for things like sporting goods stores, skin creams, any number of products, Ovaltine, to represent the modernity of the sport. So you get these interesting intermixings of women practicing skiing or being shown with the iconography with skiing. I should note here as an aside that oftentimes they don't show women in the act of skiing because that's deemed too masculinizing. But if you show them with skis in a sweater and a hat and ski boots, it suggests the modernity of the sport and also allows for whatever product you're selling to take on this allure of cosmopolitanism, of fashion, of modernity in the sport. So you really see this, again, very symbiotic relationship where the sport is benefiting from its use in mass culture, and the culture itself, the products that are being sold, are trying to draw on the allure of skiing. And I think women become a prominent way to do this in the 1920s and 1930s. Mm-hmm.
So in the 1920s and 30s, and you're talking about this, that in the advertisements, in the promotions for skiing, it's presented as a modern activity. And yet at the same time, and there were writers who I guess you could call theorists of skiing, emphasized that this was also, in the 1920s and 30s, this was also something of a traditional activity.
Right. Yeah, this is really the core idea that lays at the foundation of my book is this idea that I call Alpine Modernism, in which the sport is viewed as a kind of art. And I think that thinking about it as art and using some of the concepts and terms of artistic theory is something that skiers themselves are doing, and it helps us to really understand how sport can be more than just a kind of mindless leisure activity, but something that in fact is active, productive, interpretive. And so Alpine Modernism is the term that I have given this, that I use to describe this mix of, as you say, tradition, the fact that this is a seemingly timeless practice. It's been stretched back or traced back to 6,000 BC. So this is something that is congruent with human civilization, essentially. And this connects to the more romantic ideas behind the sport, that the sport itself is romantic, but that it's also romantic, as we mentioned, because it connects these harried modern urbanites with something eternal. And that's the mountains themselves, the Alps. And so the Alps here are so key as the geographical context for what we see developing here in terms of the meanings of the sport, because of the feelings of sublimity that they inspire in people. And so this is something that's been trained in Europeans since the late 18th century with the rise of the Romantic movement. And even though we see a decline of Romanticism as an artistic aesthetic in the later 19th century, it's still the framework through which Europeans are viewing the mountains themselves. So skiing up to World War II in particular continues to have these associations of romanticism, connecting with nature, getting away from it all, tradition. And yet, this is combining with this new modern culture of speed, consumption, luxury. And so Alpine Modernism, for me, is this blend of tradition and modernity, in which this tension, this paradox, is not something that pulls the sport apart, at least in this time period, but it allows it to be all things to all people. They don't have to make a choice between romanticism, tradition versus modernity. They can have their cake and eat it too, essentially. And there are all of these wonderful quotations and scenes from films, for example, that talk about and depict this feeling of the multiplying effect that the mountains and speed have on one another. So speed doesn't distract or detract from your appreciation of the mountains. It multiplies it. When you're viewing the mountains at speed, it inspires these feelings of ecstasy that you just can't compare with in any other form of life. And so skiers make these arguments in this time period that basically they get the best of both worlds. They get this feeling of contentment and return to nature that defines mountain climbing, hiking, camping, these kinds of leisure activities. And it also allows you to have this sense of mastery, conquest, control that you see in concurrent cultures of the bicycle, the airplane, the automobile. And so it's essentially hybridizing these two different cultures. And this is what I argue makes for the great appeal and the great growth of skiing in this time period, that these cultural ideas that surround the sport and that skiers are putting out into the world, in fact, inspire the kinds of touristic modernization that we often assume comes before the growth of skiing. So I think the culture precedes this economic development in many ways, or at least coincides with it.
Mm-hmm. As you were talking there, I was thinking of ski areas I've visited, resort towns I've visited in Europe, in the Alps. And you do see this even today, the gondolas and the ski lifts and the big machinery, the snowmaking machinery that's parked off to the side of the groomed slopes, and the clothing and the high-tech skis and bindings. And yet every area where you have restaurants, cafes, the accommodations, they're all done in something like this rustic alpine style, where you get the sense that you're stepping, even the interiors of rooms, I'm thinking of places where I've stayed, you know, it's all done in old varnished wood and so forth, to get the sense that you're staying in a cottage in the mountains.
Right. Yeah. And I think, I mean, this, they're constantly blending, whether we're talking about people selling skiing or people's perceptions of the sport as they're practicing it, as they're going on these vacations, whether we're talking about 1910 or 1980 or 2015, people are constantly engaging in this sort of synthesis of what's eternal and timeless and natural and what's modern and cosmopolitan and luxurious. And as you see the development of the sports, the widespread democratization after World War II, you begin to see sort of niche marketing. So the sorts of decor that you're talking about is often associated with the Eastern Alps, the areas of Switzerland, yes. Austria, mm-hmm. and Germany that were the cradle of the sport in many ways. And so when the French and the Italians are trying to enter into this this form of economic development after World War II, they essentially decide to differentiate themselves as being hyper-modernists. Mm-hmm. They build these huge hotel towers, massive lift infrastructure, and their approach is to say, Eastern Alps are old, we are modern, we are new, here's the new form of skiing. And then you start to get this debate about, you know, what's the proper form of a chalet? Do you want to stay in a chalet or do you want to stay in a hotel? And so this gets wrapped up in all of these broader debates about developments and the modern world and the urbanization of the mountains, which I think is very fascinating. Skiing as both a vector for these debates, but one that actually informs and creates these debates in many areas as well.
Mm-hmm. In moving to the post-war period, I want to ask about thinking of the Eastern Alps. You make an interesting point, and I had never thought of this, and it really makes great sense, that the development of post-war Austria is strongly linked to skiing.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating just tidbit of history.
Yeah. Yeah.
That with the end of World War II, I mean, many of these countries that become the major areas where alpine skiing is practiced, particularly after the war, are utterly destroyed. I mean, they've just been caught up in the war for many years, and particularly in southern Germany, in western Austria, these alpine areas, where at the very end of the war, you have some major bombings occurring. So Austria, after the war, there's planning going on in Vienna about how to rebuild. What's the future pathway for Austria? And essentially, you see this shift taking place where they recognize that after the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire after World War I, with the failure of this unified Greater Germany during World War II, that Austria needs to carve out a new space for itself. It no longer has ports on the Adriatic and huge industrial concerns in Slovakia and what's now the Czech Republic. So what is Austria's future going to look like? And they essentially make a concerted decision not to reinvest in rebuilding and redeveloping the industrial stock of Austria, but basically to focus on what Austria's main natural resource is. And this is, in the case of the cities, culture for cultural tourism. And in the case of Western Austria, it's the Alps themselves. And so they say, this is our competitive advantage economically in regards to the rest of Europe. So we need to invest in developing the touristic infrastructure. There are certainly some very famous and lucrative tourist destinations in Western Austria and the Alps before World War II. But essentially with the economic recovery program, the Marshall Plan, when Austria accepts this money, they put huge amounts of it into building roads and train lines up into Western Austria, into the Alps, rebuilding hotels that have been destroyed during the war. But I think also very interestingly, building ski lifts, basically saying we have to project our advantage and our history of winter tourism into the future and remake the sport to suit the needs of tourists after World War II. So they're banking on the recovery of Europe and particularly Western Europe as a whole, saying that if we make these investments now in the late 1940s and early 1950s, these benefits will accrue to us in the coming decades. And they do so very successfully here, recasting themselves as basically a land of tourism. So cultural tourism in the lowlands and alpine tourism, particularly winter tourism in the highlands. And this is, I think, is a very interesting transition because it's particularly after World War II that you see Austria and many alpine communities across the Alps recognizing that winter tourism can be far more lucrative than summer tourism because you can charge people for lift tickets. People need to buy all of the equipment that you need to practice skiing, later snowboarding. You can essentially keep them captive in these small towns, and they will support restaurants and agricultural producers and bars and discos and everything else. This becomes an integrated economic model that connects primary, secondary, and tertiary forms of economic production. And so it's a great investment on their part that really pays dividends after the war.
Andy, you had mentioned earlier the appearance of skiing in films in the post-war period. And one of your later chapters opens with an account of James Bond on skis. And so Bond first appears on skis, as you explain, in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, the 1969 film. But probably even more famous to listeners is the opening ski chase from The Spy Who Loved Me in 1977. So why is James Bond on skis so important?
Yeah, this I think really shows a shift that occurs, particularly in the 1960s. So to give a bit of context here for skiing in film, you do see ski films developing in the 1920s and 1930s, particularly in German Europe. This becomes an offshoot of the well-studied Bergfilm genre. And in fact, Leni Riefenstahl gets her start as an actress in these so-called mountain movies, and eventually as a skier in a film called Der Weiße Rausch, White Ecstasy. And these films are essentially sort of plotless spectacles. There's a very flimsy plot, which is basically meant to set up a situation where you can show these beautiful alpine vistas, but in particular so that you can show the appeal of skiing, the spectacle of skiing, the motion of it. This is the sort of broader of appeal of alpine modernism that I'm talking about. And so these things are popular, particularly in the late 20s and early 1930s. And these kinds of films pop up again in the 1950s. But by the time we get to the 60s, where we have this globalized mass culture, I think it appearing in a Bond film in the late 1960s is very indicative of this shift of skiing from something which is a kind of upper middle class and oftentimes elite practice, although becoming more democratized, to something which is fundamentally binds this mass culture across the globe. And so we all know the visual signifiers of Bond. He's going to be at a beach. He's going to drive his Aston Martin. He's going to be surrounded by supermodels. And the fact that in 1969, part of this new allure is that he is skiing, I think is quite indicative of the way that the sport has entered the mainstream, but also suggests this kind of luxury and cosmopolitanism. So another of the I think tensions that really drive skiing forward is that it becomes more and more democratized in Europe in the post-war period, and yet it retains these associations of elitism, of luxury, of going on these vacations, so that James Bond skiing is of a kind with, in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, him lounging on a beach in Portugal, with him bedding various women. This is all part of his masculine allure. And so skiing, I think, becomes a major part of that construction. And then it gets recycled ad infinitum, right? We see this every couple of James Bond movies into the present day, because this is something that he does. This suggests his power, masculinity, and I think indeed modernity.
Mm-hmm. Andy, we're almost out of time. I want to finish up by asking about a statement you make early in the book about skiing as a modern sport. And you say that the team sports are really, so baseball, soccer, basketball, are really 19th century sports, but skiing is a 20th century sport. Can you explain how we can see skiing as you've talked about it as a modern sport, but really as a 20th century sport?
Yeah, I mean, part of this has to do with just the sheer timing of it. So the major team sports that come to dominate culture throughout the 20th century, like soccer, like baseball, are inventions of the mid 19th century, essentially. And so their rules, their aims, insofar as there are any, are tied into many of the concerns of the mid 19th century. So there's been much work done on soccer and British cultures of masculinity and fair play and these sorts of things, right? Skiing, even though it's developed in Scandinavia in the 19th century, I argue that it becomes truly modern and central to global culture in the 20th century. And this is because the practice of it so accords with these more modern 20th century sorts of ideals. So I think one of these we've already talked about is this culture of speed, of conquest, of mastery of both the self and of the environment. And I think as well, the way that this sport can be so easily and obviously commodified. I think in many ways, skiing helps to sort of break the stranglehold of 19th century style amateurism in the IOC, for example. Avery Brundage in the late 60s and early 70s makes it his mission to remove alpine skiing from the Olympics entirely because he sees it as solely a sort of tourism advertisement for these various countries, which means that all of these skiers are corrupted. They're receiving money on the side. And so he sees this as truly dangerous. I see it as being a kind of, first example of what we come to see in other sports, like, say, European soccer, where you get the total commodification of advertising on uniforms, of pitchmen on the side. And so I think skiing as this individual sport where you can pick out these celebrities, whether it's Jean-Claude Killy in 1968 or his predecessor, the Austrian Toni Seiler in 1956, who similarly is basically forced out of competitive skiing in order to pursue his various business interests. I think it very much comes to create this culture of a sort of fusion of competitive sport and capitalist endeavor that is, I think, very much a trailblazer in the 20th century.
You've been listening to an interview with Andrew Denning about his book, Skiing into Modernity, A Cultural and Environmental History, published in 2014 by the University of California Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects like religion, politics, history, biography, popular music, and more. Go to newbooksnetwork.com to find the subjects you're interested in. If you like what you heard here, please follow us on Twitter at New Books Sports or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening and enjoy your week.